Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hello. And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. Haven't heard from you for a while, Jack. What have you been doing?
I've been looking after the internet and all these delays and just trying to keep on top of it. It's a nightmare. I mean, this morning we've heard about Jurassic World.
Yes.
It's a lot.
Let's talk about that in a minute. But first, let's just look at what we'll be looking at this week that is actually available in the cinema. We are looking at St. Maud, and we're also talking to the director and writer of that, Rose Glass, as well as looking at Miranda July's Cajillionaire and also the 40-year-old version. But yes, shall we have a little talk about that news of everything moving? Obviously, the biggies, Bond and Dune, have left the 2020 building. Cinemas are under threat. Cineworld is closing. Odeon is looking at going for a weekend-only model. What on earth are we going to do? Can we do anything to ensure cinemas are going to survive? And will we actually have anything left to watch? Will Wonder Woman and Free Guy and Death on the Nile shift too? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a big question. Although I guess we have to say before we get to the films and what this means for the future, that obviously our sympathies go out to the thousands of Cineworld and Pitchhouse employees who found out they were losing their jobs from the front page of a newspaper,
which is
pretty awful thing on many levels. And we've all been to the cinema multiple times over the last couple of months. I think it's fair to say that the staff did sort of everything they could to make the cinema feel like a safe, welcoming space again, given everything that's going on. So it's kind of devastating news to hear for them, especially. Mm. And we can only hope that the situation improves sooner rather than later. But yeah, to answer your question, Jane, it feels like really the only thing for me that's going to improve things at this point, outside, you know, the entire planet being miraculously vaccinated overnight, is the studios actually stepping up and scheduling a steady stream of major releases.
Yeah, and committing to the things that are left in the year.
Exactly. Because at this point, it's hard to argue that anyone other than the studios themselves are to blame. They're the ones doing the biggest harm to cinemas at this point. They did everything they could to ensure that cinema goers would be safe at a substantial cost to them, I'm sure. And, you know, Tenet and Warner Brothers aside, really no one's stepped up and given cinemas those tent poles that they need to prop up the whole exhibition space. So it really feels like at this point there's nothing to do except to actually release films.
Yeah, we could probably do things like we could get memberships to our local cinema. We go to the cinemas that are open and ensure that they have our money and our footfall to show that there's the appetite there, I suppose. But yeah, as you say, it feels like it's very much out of our hands as consumers. What do you think, Jack?
It's really hard because there's the Tenet argument that it was released in cinemas. There was still an appetite for it, but it wasn't perhaps as big as, you know, Warner Bros. Wanted it to be. You know, it was Nolan's, you know, lowest grossing film since The Prestige. But the difference between Tenet and something like Bond is that everyone and their mums and their grandmas are going to go see Bond. Your mum doesn't really know maybe who Christopher Nolan is or what Tenet is. And it's
mum doesn't, definitely.
It's like a really tough film. We all love Nolan, but it's a tough film to kind of get your head around. And also, like, you know, word of mouth isn't spreading quite how it used to. You know, we're not going down the pub and kind of talking about a movie afterwards, which Tenet is basically made for.
Absolutely.
So you need that big movie that's going to get everyone going. And Bond could have been that. And it's such a shame to see it go. I understand, you know, Eon maybe don't release that many movies and Bond's their big one and they want to give it the best run it can. But you still need something, you know. And maybe it could have been that film that changed things. Maybe Tenet wouldn't have done as well anyway, even if there wasn't a pandemic going on. I don't know. Again, I just feel really sorry for everyone who works in cinemas. You know, I've been to the Picture House around here in Brighton and it felt really safe. Everyone did such a good job. And, you know, I went to go see Bill and Ted. That was really, really fun. It just feels such a shame. You know, I don't really have any other options other than the Odeon now down here. And they're not showing stuff like St. Maud, which we'll talk about. So, you know, that's such a cost to actual cinema goers as well. We won't be able to see these excellent films.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also part of that thing as well, I think, with all of this COVID thing. It's the fact that normal things have become abnormal. And if you don't go to the cinema and there isn't something there for you to see, it feels like a weird thing to do, and then it becomes a weird thing to do. And having a steady stream of releases in the cinema would mean that it was normal. It feels normal, and you should go about your business and do it, just as we're going to the supermarkets and getting our food and things like that. These are the things that are now becoming like these weird, where it would feel very strange to go to a gig now, wouldn't it? Or a festival or something like that. And it's, how do we bring that normality back to it? And hopefully next year, when there's more releases and they do release, hopefully that will happen again.
Yeah, not to get too political about it, but I do feel like the government should have introduced a scheme. You know, they did Eat Out to Help Out, which were, you know, encouraged us all to go back to the restaurants and kind of broke the seal of going back to restaurants and kind of made you think like, oh, this is normal again. If they'd done something for cinemas, you know, two tickets for one or whatever, you know, we would have all been like, oh, I've been once, I've seen it's really safe. I understand, you know, all the protocols in place, what I need to do, wearing a mask, all that, you know, and it could have just helped a wave of new people go to the cinema. It's been a slightly shambolic handling of it, I would say.
Well, we do have this weekend to go and see things. So please do, if you're thinking about it, from what we've sort of seen, it is really very well organized. Shall we have a look at what we can see this weekend in a good old cinema? First up, get on your knees for this.
Hi, Umod.
Yes, hi. It takes nothing special to mop up after the dying.
You're prettier than the last one.
But to save a soul, that's quite something.
Bless Amanda's body and bless her mind, which is shrouded in darkness.
When you pray, do you get a response?
Oh, it's like he's physically in me. It's how he guides me.
My little savior.
Okay, so this is Saint Maud, which is the story of a carer, Maud, played by Moffat Clark, whose religious beliefs hide a traumatic past and lead to some harrowing events when she begins to look after a gregarious cancer sufferer played by Jennifer Ely. It's directed and written by newcomer Rose Glass, and I sat down to chat with her this morning for a little bit of a communion. We first met like a year ago at the LFF when St. Maud was in official competition and I was on the jury for that. And we gave you a special commendation and called it a dazzling debut.
You were on the jury. Oh, well, thank you very much. I remember, yeah, that was
really cool. It's been a sort of long time sort of coming to get to this, hasn't it?
I can't believe that was a year ago now, though. It's all gone crazily quickly.
Yeah.
And the world feels crazy now anyway.
Yes.
It's just crazy on top.
Yes, indeed. It feels very much like a film of our times now, because it's sort of about people who are sort of isolated and dealing with mental health and loneliness. Do you think it sort of weirdly arrived at the right time for audiences?
Maybe. I mean, it is strange how sort of timely some of the themes now appear to be, considering that obviously it was written and made before all of this stuff happened, all the things that you just mentioned. I guess we'll see. I'm still very curious to see what regular audiences actually think of it. It's one of those things of whether, when the world is potentially scary and falling apart, are people going to want to see something frightening? I hope so. I think hopefully there's something about being scared within the safety of a cinema in a kind of like fun group context, rather than just being deeply freaked out by looking at the news. Maybe that will be a more attractive kind of fear.
And obviously, if you're going to see a horror film, it's great to see it with a community sort of spirit where everyone's scared together and you get that sort of
sense
of fear.
That's definitely been the thing that I've enjoyed most about seeing the film with audiences. And I feel really lucky that I got to do that quite a lot before lockdown happened, you know, at festivals and things, and having vocal reactions at the places that you want them, people laughing or wincing or jumping in the right spots. That's kind of most satisfying, because I kind of feel a lot of those reactions are sort of involuntary. Like with a lot of drama, you can say, oh, well, it's ambiguous and you can interpret it this way or that way. But with scaring somebody or making somebody laugh, it either works or it doesn't.
Yes.
So there's something scary about that. It's good to watch with people.
Absolutely. So tell me about where your inspiration for this came from. You know, have you ever met a girl like Maud? What was the genesis for this?
I haven't met a girl exactly like Maud, maybe, but she's certainly got a weird amalgamation of traits and stuff that I might have stolen from people and myself and a lot of imagination as well. But I started coming up with a rough early version of the idea when I was finishing film school in 2014. And in the beginning, it was going to be a two-hander between Maud and God. And like God was going to be a voice that you were going to hear. And it was more of a weird romance. You know, young woman hears the voice of God inside her head and falls in love with him. But then that sort of, as I started developing the story, that started to feel a little bit gimmicky. And I got a bit more just intrigued in who this woman was and what the deal was with this voice she was hearing. Like, is it really God or is she suffering some kind of delusions? And yeah, I guess it just sort of developed from there.
And so when you were sort of developing further, were there sort of touchstones of other films you'd seen and styles you liked? Because this sort of, people have said this recalls Carrie and all sorts of touchstone horror. Were there things that you were using as a guiding light?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, obviously when you're writing stuff, you try not to think about it too consciously and you're kind of like, oh, I'm entirely original and coming up with myself. But of course, we're all totally influenced by all the stuff we've seen and absorbed. Weirdly, Carrie wasn't one. Like Carrie and The Exorcist were ones which people mentioned afterwards, which is obviously insanely flattering and cool, but I've kind of not seen them since I was a teenager, I don't think, and I've kind of forgotten. But the ones that I was thinking of were more things like Repulsion, Rosemary's Baby, in terms of some of the like visual style. I think from the first time I saw Repulsion, particularly as a, I don't know, late teens or something, what I love is just the simplicity, I guess, like how much you can do with such a simple concept. And particularly when you're making sort of a first time film and, you know, budgets are tight, I think I kind of held onto that thing of wanting to keep this story as contained and intimate as possible, but at the same time, make it as big and grand kind of visually as you can. Do a lot with a little, I guess. And then other films like The Devil's film, I think in terms of allowing myself to fully go with campy religious mania and sort of the ridiculous theatre of it. But yeah, I love that film. It's phenomenal. And I think I suggested to Jennifer and more of it, the actors in the film, I suggested that they watch a few Bergman films, Through a Glass Darkly, The Silence and Persona were generally the three that I suggested they check out. I told more of it to rewatch Taxi Driver. And Travis Bickle was like something that I mentioned to some execs earlier on in development, just in terms of trying to get the sort of tone and feel of the character in their heads, of like how they see themselves. It's a bit like try imagining if Travis Bickle was like a young Catholic woman living in an English seaside town sort of thing. And that seems, I think, the tone of things. A weird bunch of stuff.
Yeah. And tell me about the sort of process of casting. Obviously, you've got these two amazing performances from these two women. How did you go about that and what did they bring to it for you?
With the role of Maud, we did a fairly traditional casting route, I guess. We started doing auditions on and off, maybe up to a year before we started shooting. At that point, there was still no guarantee that the film was going to happen. I think a lot of it hinged on like, okay, can you find someone who can play this role? And then, because otherwise the whole film falls apart. She's like in every shot and blah, blah, blah. And Morvith was like one of the last people we saw. And Jennifer, obviously, we just offered her the role and she said yes, which was incredible. And that's kind of what got things kicked into motion, I think. Once she'd said yes and had availability to shoot, then it was like, great, you have the green light. So that was wonderful. I guess it was quite cool sort of working with very kind of established actor and sort of newbie as well. Like it's Morbius' first lead role in a film. So I think it was a sort of an equally big deal for both her and me. And then Jennifer sort of came in as this like sort of wise, cool, nurturing kind of role. But I think what they both have, I never know how to say all this stuff without sounding like really gushing and sort of lovely-ish, but like they're obviously phenomenal actors and just very talented and versatile. Kind of in terms of like how they look on screen, but also the kind of performances they have are both very sort of natural and effortless. Each of them can take some like really ridiculous or pretentious sounding line and just make it sound very kind of natural and throwaway, which I thought was important in a film like this where the tone is very kind of, you know, theatrical at times and even sort of a bit campy and, you know, some pretty like bonkers out there stuff happens. And so but it needed to be very grounded in like very natural, real human performances, I guess.
And obviously the sort of location of that ties into it, this sort of Scarborough as this very bleak seaside town. I think if any of us have been to Scarborough in a winter's day, we can recognise that. But it also sort of taps into that social realism as well. How did you choose Scarborough? And was it always going to be a seaside town? Or was that something that sort of came out of the process of developing this?
No, it was always going to be a seaside town. I think in the very beginning, I'd vaguely been thinking Hastings, just because like one of my friends is from there and I used to go there a lot. But yeah, I always wanted it to be a seaside town. And I think a lot of English seaside towns have this kind of weird, forgotten, slightly timeless, hard to place vibe. I hadn't been to Scarborough before. Me and my producers just did a little recce sort of touring the UK coast, which was really fun. And Scarborough just seemed to sort of have everything we wanted in it. I think it just looks extraordinary. It looks fantastic on camera. I don't know, it's just a very cinematic place, particularly around that seafront. Like just, it just had everything we needed with the visual style of it. I was always trying to sort of reflect Maud's state of mind in some way. And she's a person who finds reality and people in the world quite intimidating and a bit overwhelming. So I wanted it to be set somewhere which had the potential to be quite sort of garish and overwhelming, I guess, on camera.
Yeah.
I think it's very beautiful, but like you said, there is this slightly sort of like forgotten feel to it, and the whole film lives in this weird little bubble.
Had some good fish and chips, I hope, whilst
you were... Well, the guys from the fish and chip shop ended up coming and being extras in the beach scene at the end. So that was nice.
Which we won't mention what that beach scene at the end is, because that's quite...
Yes, maybe not.
But actually, talking about that sort of thing, there are some very sort of arresting images in this film, very sort of gruesome scenes. Were any of them particularly difficult to pull off? I mean, and as you talked about tone earlier, it's quite tricky to do that without it becoming ridiculous. Were any of those particular scenes hard?
Yes, I mean, probably particularly the one at the end.
Yeah,
I won't go into that one. That was a tricky one. I mean, a lot of it's the most fun bits as well, to be honest, but they are tricky. So, I mean, there's that bit's in the trailer, I guess. At one point in the film, Maud's kind of reached a particular low point and is kind of questioning her faith, and God kind of pulls her back from the brink, and she has a kind of burst of euphoria, epiphany, whatever, God kind of reaching out to her again. So there's this levitation. And for quite a while, we couldn't work out how to do it because we have quite limited budget. So I think we were looking into doing like wires and green screens and stuff like this. But then in the end, we found like a sort of thing that's used to move boxes in warehouses onto big shelves. And we just kind of put more of it on that and then just VFX'd it out. All those bits were the most fun. Anything involving stunts that was all very nerve wracking and new. She gets thrown across the room and smashes into a dressing table at one point. And we had this amazing stunt performer, Nadia, who was so young. She's like, I don't know, early 20s or something. And just doing all this like really dangerous looking stuff. And I'm like, God, what a strange profession.
I'll never look at a drawing pin the same again. Let's just say that.
Oh, yeah. It's funny that like this, when you're writing it, making it, obviously you like the whole script is so kind of deeply normalized for me because I've been working on it for so long. So it's just like, oh yeah, so now's the scene with the pins and this and that. And I think by that point in the shoot, the crew was all the same. You know, some of the crew members who maybe hadn't read the whole script or something were a bit kind of surprised at first, particularly when we started filming Maud's first like Godgasm scenes. And they'd be like, oh, what's going on here? Mm. But I think by the time we shot the pins, everyone was just like, oh, another day.
That's the scene that audiences really wince at.
I know, exactly. It's kind of, it's really stuck out. And it's the close-up shot where you see her putting the pins in. We had got like a special aspect prop done, so those pins actually were sort of breakaways, so we did actually hold the shot for long enough for her to like put her feet down in one take, but the timing just didn't work. But yeah, it was lots of fun.
As this is a horror film and it has these amazing moments in it, what sort of horror film was formative for you when you were growing up? What sort of haunted you and has stayed with you since you've seen it?
I mean, to be honest, Rosemary's Baby is sort of pretty much my favorite film. To me, it's kind of a perfect movie. I can't remember if that was one that I saw particularly younger or haunted me. I mean, it did. Is Razorhead a horror film?
It depends who you ask, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I think, to be honest, a lot of the films that really stuck with me when I was younger were ones which were kind of, you know, like that and Pie, weirdly, like Darren Aronofsky's first film. As like a young teenager, I think I saw both those films at a similar sort of time. And I guess neither of them are quite horror films, but they're both very kind of disturbing. And that kind of stuff always seemed to stick with me. I remember watching Dumplings. Yeah, that horror film. And that was pretty very icky inducing. And I'm not like a squeamish person generally. And I was really just kind of appalled, but in like a very, you know, in a great way, kind of like, oh God. I think around that point, I was just starting to work out, oh, films can be like this. It can be sick and twisted and fun.
I sincerely hope that St. Maud is going to be appalling people this weekend.
Yay.
And haunting them. Obviously, it's a tricky time for cinemas, but we're going to encourage everyone to get out and see it. So we hope that they'll be horrified. So thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks so much. Really nice to talk to you.
So that was Rose Glass talking about St. Maud. We talked about it there being horrifying and some truly memorable moments that really make you wince. Did it do it for you?
I thought this was an extraordinary film, all the more extraordinary because it's a debut from a writer-director, really impressive work. First and foremost, it's been, you know, talked up as this horror film, but first and foremost, for me, it was a character study. Obviously, Rose, in your interview, compared it to films like Repulsion and Rosemary's Baby, so she said those were the horror films that influenced her as a filmmaker growing up, and you can really see the through line from those films to this. Because it centers on this character, Maud, the eponymous Maud. And the whole film isn't so much a sequence of objective events as things that we're subjected to from Maud's subjective point of view.
Yes.
So you never entirely know what is literally happening and what is part of Maud's possible psychosis, or whether she is actually experiencing this spiritual awakening where she's having conversations with God and she believes she has this devout calling to save the soul of Jennifer Ely's Amanda. So that's what really worked for me. It really puts you in the mindset of this character who is bordering on some kind of meltdown, but you're not quite sure what's going on. So that's what really thrilled me about this film.
Jack?
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this. I think I was expecting, because obviously, like, you expect a horror film to be very, very scary. I didn't find it scary particularly. I mean, it still haunted me afterwards, but in a different way. I think while I was watching it, it was just so difficult to watch in places, because you are wincing and you're just feeling this pain throughout your body. You know, there's a scene where, which you spoke about, with the nails in the shoes, when she's walking along, and it's just your whole body just, oh, I could barely watch. I had to turn away. It was quite an experience. but I definitely one I'd recommend. And, you know, it all builds to this final shot as well, which I won't spoil, but it's definitely a fun, really interesting ending that brings it all around really, really nicely. And for a debut filmmaker, it just feels so sure of itself and just super impressive. Like, it's definitely a reason to go to the cinema.
It is from those people who sort of brought us Hereditary and films like that, that are not necessarily horror. It's what people would term sort of quite snobbily elevated horror, isn't it? And it's horrifying, but not necessarily sort of slasher horror. And I agree with Jordan. I really enjoyed the idea of being inside this woman's head and wanting to sort of reach out to her and be like, no, that's not necessarily what's happening here. There's a lot of backstory that's fascinating with her to deal with. You know, is she having post-traumatic stress disorder from an incident that happened when she was a nurse with the NHS? Is it something about sort of bullying? Is there a slut shaming element to this? There's all sorts of things going on, but it's just really for me about isolation and loneliness. And would things have gone differently had someone actually reached out to Maud and connected with her? People do try, but no one really connects with her. And maybe it wouldn't have been so tragic. And that's what's so sad and horrifying about it for me, and what I really loved about it. And also, being from Yorkshire, I enjoyed seeing Scarborough. Lovely Scarborough, where I've spent many of my summers. They have very good trampolines on the beach and donkeys. But yeah, it looks so bleak in this, doesn't it?
Yeah, the setting like really reinforces the sense of isolation and loneliness. I like how British seaside has become like a cinematic shorthand for just a bleak, horrible life nowadays. Yeah. Like, how much you feel if you live in Scarborough, having your town portrayed that way all the time. But yeah, it's beautifully shot. And I just love the shots of her just like walking along the coast, along the beach and stuff. It really does put you in her shoes, her horrible pin-laden shoes. Yeah, it's a really surprisingly beautiful looking film as well, because it's, you know, small budget film. It's an hour and 24 minutes. It's like a real sort of jolt to the system. Clearly not made for a great deal of money, but you can't really tell. A lot of care and attention went into this film.
My least favorite, by that I mean most cringeworthy scene, was the one in the pub where she tries to join in a conversation. And I was like, this is why I'm very happy staying at home right now. I like don't want to go see other people and go through that experience again. That was terrifying.
Yeah. I also like the fact that although this is set in modern day, you could put her in a bonnet and this could be a Victorian sort of gothic melodrama and it would work on that level as well.
Yeah, it feels really timeless.
Yeah, very sort of could be any era, and very much about, you know, women that are working in jobs like that are sort of overlooked, and nurses working really hard on very little pay, not really ever asked if they're doing okay. And so I found that very interesting.
Yeah, the kind of hillside mansion that Amanda's cancer patient lives in kind of reminded me of something like something like The Haunting on Hill House or something like that, like some real gothic Universal horror mansion. Like, it really didn't feel like something from the present day, but at the same time it did feel kind of weirdly modern as well. There's something about the whole film which they've done a really good job of creating this weird sense of time and place around it where you never really know where you are.
It does feel like it should be a ghost story in places. I think that's why the way it unfolds and the complex this lead character has. It's surprising. It feels fresh as well. It doesn't feel like you've seen this a million times or anything. It does feel very new and interesting, especially someone who thinks they're basically God's chosen one. You know, it's a fun spin on horror, and it all builds and works up, you know, all the elements you're talking about, Jane, with all the backstory and stuff. It does all feel just so organic and lived. It's yeah, it's really fun. Yeah.
But also it's completely ambiguous, in as much as you could watch this and view it entirely as a depiction of someone who has been chosen by God. You could watch it that way if you wanted to. It's up to you to sort of decide. I mean, we are given hints that it isn't really that. But in terms of how it's presented and how she feels about it, this is absolutely what's happening to her. And that's really kind of interesting too.
And I thought Morford Clark was just extraordinary. We've seen her in a few smaller roles. If you watch the His Dark Materials TV show, she pops up in that. And
she's in David Copperfield.
She was in Eternal Beauty, which we reviewed last week, of course. And this is a real sort of calling card performance. It's totally centered on her the entire film. She goes through the whole gamut of emotions, totally vulnerable, at times quite scary and intimidating. There's tons of range in this performance. It's one of those performances that I think people will look back on in a few years and go, yeah,
that's when we knew started. There, she is.
Yeah. When she's up on the Oscar stage, we knew back when we saw St. Maud.
And the same, I think, is true of Rose Glass as well as a director. I mean, if she can do this on her first feature film out the gate, what could she do if she was given a bigger budget and even more sort of free rein to go mad?
Yeah, it's so assured. It's so confident. It's so innovative. Yeah, it's a real, really impressive piece of work.
I'm looking forward to seeing Morford as Galadriel in the Lord of the Rings show on Amazon.
Of course you are. You Lord of the Rings nerd.
Yeah, you love a bit of that.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Like, I mean, you kind of summed it up nicely with like her, you know, she's able to do this intimidating presence. You know, it's something like David Copperfield. She was a completely different character, completely different set of, you know, muscles being stretched. And I think it's made me very excited for that show. So, and her in it.
Definitely. She sort of reminds me a little bit of Shirley Henderson in that way, that she can play very, very sweet, but also terrifyingly sweet as well. I think she's great, and I think everybody needs to go out and see this performance. So this is out at cinemas, real cinemas, everybody, this Friday. Please go and see it and support your local cinema. Okay, let's go from one idiosyncratic young woman with a screwed up belief system to another. Let's take a look at this.
You're addicted to them.
They're my parents.
In what sense?
We split everything three ways. We have since I was little. I don't want to do it that way this time.
Don't.
You want us to be false, faking people. We don't make pancakes or wrap up little birthday presents or call you sweetheart or baby or
do a little dance.
Okay, so that is Kajillionaire from Miranda July. Jordan, who's a kajillionaire? Is anybody in this a kajillionaire? Doubt it.
Certainly not old Dolio and her family, who are the kind of grifter con artist family at the heart of this film. They're very much living on the poverty line. It's sort of their dream to be kajillionaires, I guess you would say. But yeah, this is the return of Miranda July to screens. It's been best part of a decade since The Future, her last film. And you may have also seen Me and You and Everyone We Know, which was her debut. And if you've seen those two films, you'll sort of know what to expect going into this. There's this sort of streak of gentle absurdism to the whole thing. But at the same time, Kajillionaire also has, I would probably say, the most plot of any Miranda July film to date as well. Like I say, it stars Evan Rachel Wood, Richard Jenkins, and Deborah Winger as this con artist family living on the poverty line. They pull these series of just absurd cons to try and basically just earn a bit of money. Like the film opens with them kind of sneaking into a post office, sticking their hand into a post box, and then grabbing mail from an adjacent post box and just chancing and seeing what they get, and they end up getting like a tie or something that's worth basically nothing. And there's this whole series of ideas that they have to scam people out of money. They live in this weird office block next to some kind of factory, where soap suds pour through the wall.
At 4:15 every day.
At 4:15 every day, they all have their watches set to an alarm to that time, so they all have to be home at that time to make sure that the soap suds are poured down the drain. So this is the kind of weirdness that you sort of expect from a Miranda July film. But what actually really impressed me about Gajillionaire is it does have kind of a serious story underneath it all. At one point, they come across this character called Melanie, played by Gina Rodriguez. And when she is introduced to the family, all these, I guess you would say, traumas from old Dolio's past sort of really start to bubble and come to the surface. Old Dolio is this character who's never been treated particularly well by her parents. She's basically been used her entire life to earn money. And she's never been treated with any real love or affection. And then when Melanie comes into the lives of Teresa and Robert, the parents, they start to treat her like she's their own daughter. And old Dolio starts to feel quite resentful and bitter about all this. And it really just goes to show that this family, even beyond the absurdism and the humour, is actually quite fucked up and dark and wrong. So for me, there was a lot more to this film than I was expecting. And there's also a whole other story going on between old Dolio and Melanie, which I won't go into too much because it kind of comes as a surprise, but I actually found that side of it really sweet and warm as well. So it was really a film that took me by surprise more than anything, because I expected it to be a sort of gentle, absurd comedy from the opening 20 minutes, but it goes to very different and unique and strange and I thought quite wonderful places.
Did you like it, Jack?
It's definitely a strange one. It's definitely one of the more absurd family depictions I've ever seen. I found it quite frustrating in places because I found the character, old Dolio, frustrating herself. You know, I just wanted her to break free and do her own thing. And also Gina Rodriguez's character. I think my issue was I didn't really understand her. And I didn't
her motivation.
Yeah, I didn't.
I had that problem too.
I didn't get why she was there. Like, or why she was hanging on with these people or doing any of it. So I think that distracted me because I was like, why doesn't she walk away from this weird family? Why is she continuing to be there with them? But without her, there wouldn't be a story.
No, so she is the catalyst for everything that sort of goes awry following her arrival. She is the catalyst for home truths and for realizations, shall we say, in certain people that does then move the story forward. But I mean, we only get this idea that maybe she has an overly clingy mother and she enjoys the sort of thrill she gets from being with parents who literally don't care about their daughter. They just view her as a tool in their pursuit of money. And also it's sort of this quite sad idea that they are, as Jordan said, they go to all these great lengths, flying across country and all sorts of things to end up with a few dollars that doesn't even cover the rent. It feels kind of very pointless, and very pointless to neglect a child for that amount of money. And this idea of them being so far from cajillionaires, it's not even that being this sort of unloving towards their offspring nets them millions of dollars. It doesn't. It's just notes at the end of the day. So that's very sort of sad and quite moving in a way. But equally, I kind of found the quirkiness. I know what Miranda July is going to be like, but at the same time, the soap bubbles and the weird landlord who cries at everything, it could be a bit jarring. It can be a bit, look at us being quirky.
There's this whole plot thread about the big earthquake that's going to hit, and the family believes that it's just going to kill everyone at some point. So every time there's like a minor tremor, they're like holding on for dear life. I mean, I sort of found all that stuff like quite amusing and often hilarious, but I can see how it could rub some people up the wrong way. And
you just have to lean into it, don't you? And just be like,
really do.
Okay, this is going to be sort of willfully quirky and I'm going to have to roll with it.
But the thing that really worked for me about that this time around is that I found it quite disarming because I went into it expecting it to be one thing because of the soap suds, because of the quakes. And then I was like, oh, actually, there's quite a lot of depth and there's quite a lot of heart and emotion to this thing. So it kind of caught me off guard in that way.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of the Family Fang, that idea of parents having children purely to facilitate their own goals in life. But also, let's talk about performances here. I mean, Deborah Winger is practically unrecognisable as the mum in her long wig. And, you know, Evan Rachel Wood with this very deep voice, this sort of very uninvolved way of talking. It's quite interesting to see these people play these parts, right?
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed Evan Rachel Wood especially, but also Richard Jenkins. I thought he was, you know, the quirky father. He was really fun. I thought Deborah Wing was slightly underused in this. Like, I thought there could have been more of a mother-daughter dynamic. I thought it would hinge perhaps more on that, but the characters were slightly more defined by these quirks that they had. So I still think, like, you know, as someone to kind of latch onto and as our, you know, perspective of old Dolio, Evan Rachel Wood did a really great job. And I think what I found unnerving about her was I had no idea like how old she was or meant to be in this. Like, it just felt very weird. You know, she dressed like she was straight out of school, like 15, 16, had kind of the mental capacity of someone of that age. And so that I found that really unnerving.
But she's actually 26 years old, we discover.
Yeah, exactly. Like, when they put out that age, that threw me off even more, because Evan Rachel Wood's also, you know, she's in her 30s. So
I guess the point of it is that this character is literally in arrested development. She hasn't formed any emotional development or anything like that because of the fact that she's been kept a child by these crazy parents. It feeds into that not knowing exactly where she sits works for that for me.
Yeah, she has such a skewed worldview. I actually spoke to Miranda July for a news piece in the magazine a couple of issues ago now, and she said that when they were developing the character, one of the touchstones for old Dolio was Edward Scissorhands, which I kind of got in retrospect.
Yeah,
this weird, lonely figure who doesn't totally know how to properly interact with the world. It made a lot of sense to me. I kind of wish I'd known going in.
Yeah, I wish I had too. That would have made me view it quite differently, I think. But it is an interesting film to go and see, right? It's going to challenge your expectations. It's fun. There's no doubt about it. It's fun. So it's out in cinemas this weekend from Friday, but it's also going to be available on demand. So would you suggest people seek this out?
Highly recommended from me.
It would come under St. Maud. But I still think it's, you know, a fun cinematic experience, especially if you're prepared for the quirkiness of it all.
Okay. And finally, on to another woman doing her directorial debut and writing debut with this.
Remember this face? She was one of Spotlight Magazine's 30 Under 30 playwrights to watch. We watched, but where'd she go?
How are you? Good. Archie tells me you're teaching.
How somebody who ain't had no real hit gonna tell me how to write a play? She ain't no Tyler Perry.
I did win a 30 Under 30 award. Yes, it was quite a couple of years ago.
What do I gotta do? Write a slave musical, an all-white play?
This some bullshit.
It rang a little inauthentic. I asked myself, did a black person really write this?
So this is the 40-year-old version. Jack, what is it about? It's not to be confused with Steve Carell.
No, absolutely not. So this is the story of Rada, who is a playwright who won a load of awards when she was under 30. She was, you know, named one of the 30 under 30 playwrights to look out for. She was supposed to have this incredible career, but now she's just about to turn 40. She's teaching theatre in a school to a load of kids. They take her seriously, but, you know, they all flirt with her and it's all, you know, a bit strange. And then she's also just not getting the productions she wants made. So she pivots to this career as a rapper. And from there, things kind of unfold. She does find her way back into theatre in parts, but she has to compromise some of her vision. It's all set in kind of Brooklyn and New York. There's a lot of kind of going around the city. And yeah, it all kind of hinges on Rada. She's able to poke fun at herself. She also directed the movie, this Lady Rada Blank, and it's kind of based on her own life experiences. So what did you guys make of it?
I actually really liked it. I didn't think it was quite as, you know, as impressive as St. Maud, if we're going to compare them. But it did feel like a real sort of calling card film for Rada Blank. I like the fact it's shot on 35mm film, all in black and white. So it has a quite distinctive visual look.
Sort of Spike Lee-ish, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Rada Blank was, a writer and producer on the TV version of She's Gotta Have It. So there's sort of the Spike Lee connection there. So you can sort of see the influence. What I really liked about this film is that it has a kind of lightness of touch to it. Obviously, it's called the 40-year-old version, the title that's trading on the idea of the 40-year-old virgin. And it is a comedy in some respects. You get these really weird, funny moments where Rod is like kneeling down or whatever and like her knees crack. It's like this odd running joke that's going through the film. And that sort of tickled me all the way through. And the fact that she becomes this rapper called Rodimus Prime, yeah. I just found like gently hilarious. And she has this rap called Poverty Porn, which is actually quite brilliant. So I did find it quite funny, but it was a bit too long for me. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes almost, and it felt like there was a better film to be found in the edit. It didn't quite feel as tight or as, I don't know, quite as involved as I always wanted to be. But as a performance piece, as a piece of humorous writing, I did really enjoy it.
Yeah, totally agree with that. I felt like it sort of was too meandering and too all over the place. And if someone had taken to edit it really quite down, I think what would have been left would have been something really quite sharp. I really enjoyed her performance and the sort of, you know, there's a lot of looking to camera and sort of double takes of weird situations, which I enjoyed. But it just felt like it was a bit like her career. Showed great potential, but never really totally went anywhere. And so I couldn't really warm to it massively as much as I really wanted to. But as you say, I think it shows that there's really interesting talent there, and I'd like to see what she'd do next.
Definitely had that Netflix bloat to it, you know, where yeah. you kind of think, yeah, it could have done with a few of the rap segments, perhaps cut down a bit. Towards the end of it felt really extra as well, that kind of whole career pivot. I guess that was the, you know, the point in the story is that she, you know, moved away from it, you know, theatre writing, and is distracted by this thing, and then, you know, goes in its own direction. And so it felt like that distraction could have been just chopped down a bit. Like, I didn't need as many raps. You know, some of them weren't that impressive.
And the fact that she turns to rap, it just felt like it was mining very similar territory to Patty Cakes. I don't know if you saw that film.
Yes.
And I just thought that film did that whole unexpected person becomes a rapper. It just felt like a lot sharper and a lot more fun. Whereas in this, it just felt like a bit too much of a distraction from the story it actually wanted to tell. But at the same time, there's a lot of stuff in this that did work for me.
I mean, one of my issues was, and this might be my age being revealed here, didn't really understand why you were so washed up at 40. 40 didn't actually feel like an age to have been completely over making anything, doing something. I realise it's probably more about the 10 years between being hailed this wunderkind to the fact that she hasn't actually produced any work of particular merit. But the fact that, you know, the creaky knees and everything, and the fact that she was too old to be attractive to the young rapping boys, and she could only pick up a weird student who was very leery. It felt a bit weird that at 40, that was it. That seemed like something that you'd be at 50 or 60, that you might be worried about that sort of thing. So I don't know, that didn't really work for me. But I did enjoy the old lady. She sort of had these portraits of people in the neighborhood who were shouting at the camera various things, and there was an old lady who's like, 40 ain't nothing, come back to me when you're 70, you know, and she's sort of running around the neighborhood, and then a homeless guy always shouting at her across the street. Those people were quite funny and felt really authentic and amusing, but yeah, it didn't quite work. I think we're all saying that, aren't we? It didn't quite work for us.
Yeah, sort of really engaging and funny and sort of fits and starts. Almost like there are sketches throughout the film that I kind of liked. But as a whole, it didn't entirely tie together and work for me.
Yeah, okay. It tried to do a lot of things, but didn't quite accomplish them all in the way I think it wanted to.
But great potential, and it is on Netflix, so it's easy to watch. So if you're fancying watching something that's a little bit different and seeing a new voice, then the 40-year-old version is available this weekend on Netflix. Okay, it's probably time to wrap up now and go off to the cinema. But before we go, I've got a reader's question for you boys. So based on the Twitter chat this week about necessary sex scenes, are sex scenes ever necessary? And in your opinion, what sex scenes in films do you consider integral to the story? Are they necessary? Are sex scenes necessary? Do they bring something to the story?
It's all circumstantial, isn't it? There's always going to be times when, you know, you have sex scenes you just really don't need. Because I did a feature in the mag earlier this year on 300 and watching that film again. And it's got this horrible sex scene in it where it's just like very, you know, huge nipple on screen, that kind of thing, and you're just like, this is so
offended by a nipple.
I was offended by the unnecessary need of the nipple.
Right,
nipples don't offend me, but I didn't need that one.
Zack Snyder's like the master of the unnecessary sex scene, isn't he? Because there's the classic one in Watchmen set to Hallelujah, which is unbelievably gratuitous. And I would cite that as an example of a completely unnecessary sex scene.
Yeah. And, you know, like, there's sex scenes that are just awful as well. You know, anything in Basic Instinct or Showgirls flapping around like a dolphin in the swimming pool. But in those films, they also serve a purpose, don't they? I mean, that's the kind of film they are, and you expect them there. But are there scenes that you think are really integral to the story that are absolutely necessary that you've seen?
Well, I've got three examples, so maybe
Jordan's investigated this a lot.
I've investigated it thoroughly. I've done my research. So my three examples are Gone Girl, which obviously has an integral sort of sex scene in terms of the, you know, mentality of the main character and revealing her actual intentions. Old Boy, which has a similarly messed up sex scene towards the end, which I won't go into details on because it's a huge spoiler, but has chilled me ever since whenever I think about it. And Disobedience, Sebastian Lelio's film from a few years ago, if you ever saw that,
which stars Rachel.
I mean, I hadn't remembered that, but
apparently lychee flavored KY jelly.
Oh, good fact. Yeah, it has a central sort of sex scene between Rachel Weisz and Rachel McAdams, but that really is super plot essential because the whole point of that film is that these two characters are part of this Orthodox Jewish community, and this is very much a forbidden sort of thing to do. So you need to see the culmination of that relationship, of that connection. So yeah, they're my examples.
Do they clash with yours, Jack, or have you been down a totally different route?
I've been down a different route. So I've got Under the Skin as one of them, because, you know, that is integral to her character, Scarlett Johansson's character. And then the other one is Call Me By Your Name, which, you know, we kind of get, it kind of tells a lot about the characters. There are kind of two to choose from in there, you know, one between two boys and then one with a peach. So, you know, both, I would say, integral to the movie. And, you know.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about inanimate objects when I was thinking about sex scenes, but that is a very famous sex scene that, yeah, it does feel like if you took that out, it wouldn't be the same film at all. My sex scenes all appear to be grief-stricken, which I realised when I was sort of thinking of them. But the scene in Monster's Ball when Halle Berry's mother, who's lost a child on death row, is grieving and just needs to feel something. And she says to Billy Bob Thornton, just make me feel good. And sex is used as a way to escape this just inescapable grief and feeling of no control. And it's something that you can do and that takes you out of that. And similarly, Don't Look Now is another one that you would think on the surface, you don't need that in a horror film, essentially. But actually, it just shows that connection between those characters. And again, they're just their absolute grief that this is something that they can do together that isn't just about mourning their daughter. And it also is the foundation on which everything else happens within that film. And then it's Itu Mama Tambiam. There's various sexual acts in that film. But again, that's sort of driven a lot by the female character who knows that she's dying and wanting to grasp life, and sex is a way to do that and to sort of defy death. So I don't know why my sex is all death, but I do think those three examples are sort of, I can't imagine the films without the sex scenes in them. They really bring a certain narrative strength to it.
Now, we're talking about sex that isn't quite sex. There's the beach scene in Moonlight as well. Yeah, that's an incredible scene. And it says so much about the characters, and it's a huge revelation for them. So this all sounds like sex scenes are quite integral when they
are.
They are.
They're artistically necessary, unless it's Showgirls or Basic Instinct or Destination Wedding, which I also remembered as having a dreadful sex scene. I mean, I would have thought a sex scene between Winona Ryder and Keanu Reeves is exactly what you want to watch, but not this one. It was for all the wrong reasons. So, yeah.
I don't know if this is what prompted the question, but presumably we're not going to have many sex scenes going forward, given the whole people have to keep their distance when filming nowadays. So maybe we've had our fill of sex scenes for the near future.
Oh, you say that, but this morning, Total Film and Games Radar published a story about sex scenes in the new Lord of the Rings TV show, to bring it back to that.
Oh, what? Stop. Just stop with your Lord of the Rings.
I don't need sex in my Lord of the Rings. What is going on?
Yeah, this is relevant. This has all been relevant, I'd like to point out. But yeah, apparently that show's going to have, they've just hired someone, you know, one of the coordinators to make sure the actors feel comfortable and stuff. I mean, that's filming now, so I guess you will have some scenes like that. But then saying that, they did cancel Glow on Netflix because that was women being intimate in wrestling. So yeah, it will be interesting to see how they go forward with all this.
I mean, everybody's going to have to be tested up to the eyeballs. And I was watching something where somebody was about to do a kissing scene and they had to gargle with really stringent antiseptic mouthwash for a minute each before they even got it stuck in. So yeah, they were clinical before sex scenes, but now they're going to be super clinical, literally.
There's that video online from, is it Days of Our Lives or whatever that American soap is, where there's a guy who's clearly like kissing just a doll, like an inanimate mannequin or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Luca Guadagnino's onto something with the whole peach sex, you know? This is the way it's going to go. People will just have to shag a fruit instead of a real person.
I think it already makes sure, like, if you're going to do a sex scene, it has to be integral. You know, none of this nonsense sex that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
I wonder if Zack Snyder's going to be inserting, so to speak, a new sex scene into the Snyder Cut of Justice League with these reshoots.
I don't think Gal Gadot will stand for that. I have hope that she won't allow any of that shenanigans to happen. She's a...
Nah, no chance.
Wonders isn't going to let that happen. Not on her watch. And on that note, shall we say goodbye? Because I think actually we could probably talk for another half hour about sex scenes, but I'm not sure we need to. I think it's unnecessary.
Yeah, that bit is unnecessary, definitely.
So on that note, let's say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.